died on Monday. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
French President François Hollande today has a message for Syrian rebels. Pull together, form a credible government, and France will recognize it. Hollande is going further than any other national leader in urging the rebels to declare themselves the legitimate representatives of the Syrian people. His message comes as the Syrian military today dropped leaflets in Damascus, telling rebels to turn in their weapons or face inevitable death. The German airline Lufthansa may have to cancel hundreds of flights in coming weeks if cabin employees go through with strike threats. Last-ditch talks over compensation at Lufthansa have collapsed. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering treatment options to patients fighting complex or advanced stage cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
Why does the Constitution matter? Well, probably if we went out and started asking people that question, they would say, well, it matters because this is the thing that protects our fundamental rights. Our guest for this hour of the show, however, has a different kind of answer. His name is Mark Tushnet, and he is professor of law at Harvard University, and we will be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in a new book that he's written, and the title is Why the Constitution Matters. It's published by the Yale University Press. And he suggests that, in fact, the Constitution matters because it provides a structure for American politics, and it's that, it's politics, that, in fact, is the ultimate source for whatever protection we have for our fundamental rights. In this part of the program, we'll talk about some of the ideas that you will find in the book, talk a little bit about the importance of, significance of both the Constitution and the United States Supreme Court. And Professor Tushnet, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure, thanks a lot.
Well, you know, I think I'm sure that you are right that if you ask people about the Constitution, what they're going to start talking about are rights and probably the things that come to mind most easily for most people are those things that are addressed in the First and Second Amendments, and maybe they also think about the parts of the Constitution that talk about who gets to vote. But I think that probably that people, when they get your basic argument, this might actually be kind of disturbing to them, the idea that something that's as subject to popular opinion and special interest as politics really is the thing that guarantees our rights, not this sort of unchanging bedrock document that we have.
I think the people might well be troubled initially, but my hope is that when people see the argument as a whole, it actually is pretty encouraging because it says that the American people, really do control the structure and the nature of the system under which we live. It's not something that's handed off to judges in Washington or something that we either blame on or give praise to the framers of the Constitution. It's actually our responsibility, so we have to think seriously about what kind of government and what kind of rights we want to have.
Mm-hmm. I think it leads one to think differently about the Supreme Court. Again, I think maybe most of the time people don't think much about the court unless it's in the news, or maybe it's addressing a particular issue that's important to them, or perhaps that they're just heavily involved in politics and they have concern about which way the court leans. But having said all that, again, what it says is that the Supreme Court is a political body, maybe not quite in the way that the Congress is, but it is a political body.
I think that's right. I mean, it's one of the, in some ways, most well-established propositions in political science and agreed to mostly by most constitutional scholars, lawyers, that the Supreme Court's overall orientation, if you look over a sort of reasonable period, is going to be pretty similar to whatever it is that's going on in politics. The basic idea is pretty straightforward. If you have Republican presidents who are conservative, who win enough elections, they're going to appoint conservative justices. And similarly with Democratic presidents, who are going to appoint, roughly speaking, liberal justices. And so overall, the court's going to look pretty much like what we've been getting out of our presidential elections.
Mm-hmm. This, I guess, also it makes me think. It makes one think, perhaps a little bit differently, also about this, the idea that we all get in civics class about the structure of government, that it has these three branches. They're supposed to be equal. They're supposed to be a check on each other's power. But that, in fact, again, if you go to this question of, well, you know, what the things that do indeed guarantee our rights, where those come from, or how we think about them, what's appropriate role for government, you think, well, really, of these three, where does the power lie? What's really the most important? And you start thinking, well, maybe, in fact, what's really most important here is the Congress, and that it may in fact, be what, you know, if you can say something about the framers, that may, in fact, be what it is they had in mind.
The framers, I think, did think that they were creating a government in which the central focus of political power would be in Congress. As history has gone on, power has shifted from Congress to the presidency for mostly over the 20th century and mostly because of the U.S.'s increasing involvement in international or foreign affairs, where the president plays a very large role and was understood to play a large role from the very beginning. But the feature, I think, that should matter is, as you suggested, not precisely where the most power is located, but how the system of interaction among all three branches works. It's important to understand, I think, that none of the branches, including the courts, which is what I, as a constitutional law person, tend to focus on, none of the branches is independent of the others. The idea is of checking and balancing, that there'll be some kinds of interactions among the branches that will produce the kind of government that we always, you know, at any moment will get the kind of government that's pretty much like what we want it to be.
Yeah. I think it's certainly also true that how these three branches are constituted and how they operate and how they relate to one another and how important they are, that is something that in part is set down on that piece of paper that's there in Washington, but also is something that, as a result of practice and maybe also as a result of the efforts of a few exceptional individuals, really has evolved over time to be something more than what is on that piece of paper.
The fixed things in the Constitution are, of course, quite important. We have two houses in Congress. They're elected. All the members of the House of Representatives are up for election every 2 years. Senators serve for 6 years, president for 2 years, for 4 years with a limitation on two terms. All of those things do provide an important structure for the politics that we have, and they are they're the fixed points in our system. Once you have those fixed points, though, there is a lot of flexibility, both in terms of the substance of what the national government can do, but also in terms of the procedures that, or the ways in which we get the laws that we want. In the book, I talk about this an idea that I've called constitutional workarounds. And there are a lot of things that are in the Constitution that may not seem sensible anymore, and there are a fair number of ways to work around them to operate the government in a way that makes sense to us today.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Mark Tushnet. He is professor of law at Harvard University, and we are talking about some of the ideas that you'll find in his recent book, Why the Constitution Matters. It's published by the Yale University Press. It is out now, and questions are certainly welcome here, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send your emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. To go here to the essential argument that what it is that's really most important about the Constitution is the structure that it gives to American politics. And you've talked about it, and people, again, will know, well, okay, we have these three branches of government. We have the legislature, the executive, we have the judicial, and we have the Supreme Court, and we have the president. And Congress has two houses, and they're constituted differently. They're made up differently and so forth. What about all this really is, do you think, is the most is important? I mean, it talked a little bit more about this notion that how that sets things up really matters.
That turns out to be a much more complicated question than I had thought before I started to work on this book. I think the dominant view, which I agree with, is that in our modern system, that is in the 21st century, the player who really matters is the president, and the way the president leads the political party of which he is the head. What's tricky about that is that political parties aren't mentioned in the Constitution at all. And so what we're observing, say, today in, let's just take an example, the Senate, where you have a unified Republican Party and a somewhat less unified Democratic Party, which is what's generating either gridlock or the kind of legislation that we're getting, depending on how you want to describe it, all of that stuff arises from a party system that is not rooted in any interesting way in the Constitution. To say that these fixed structures matter, I think, is right, but it also has to be qualified by emphasizing the importance in the modern era of national political parties, which are not described in the Constitution.
There, and it's my understanding that actually the framers, the people who were the leaders in early America, weren't entirely comfortable with the idea of parties.
That's right. At least at very early on, that is at the time of the framing, 1786, 87 through 89, 1790, the framers, the most prominent framers, described the things that we would now call political parties as factions. And James Madison quite famously said that the aim of the Constitution was to curb the influence of factions. So at that time, they were uneasy. They knew about the possibility of parties, and they were uneasy about them. Quite rapidly, within a decade, political parties nationally organized did emerge because there were conflicts over national policy that political leaders or as sort of coherent programs. We got the Federalists and the Jeffersonians within, as I say, a decade, and we've had political parties with us since then. The nature of the party system has changed over time. But again, the Constitution has almost nothing to say about how we organize our political parties.
Something else I'm sure people would say is an important hallmark of American politics, and something where over the years and still today there's a lot of dispute. It has to do with the relationship between the federal government and state governments. and who has what kind of authority, and those two things, the power center in Washington and these 50 other power centers, and how they are and always have been in tension. Is that something that actually is set up by the Constitution?
Again, it's fair to say that the Constitution creates a system of federalism with some power in the national government and other power in the state government. But the distribution of those powers, which ones are held by the national government, which ones by the state government, those questions have, I would put it as, always been negotiated over time in our political system. Things that the national government now does, it used to be thought unthinkable that the national government could do them. Things that state governments now do have sometimes been done in the past by the national government. There's generally been a flow of power to the national government over the course of our history. But again, the rate of the flow and the particular issues that become nationalized depends on the state of politics at the time.
You know, certainly I'm sure that it's true that if you look at some very basic things, and some of them are the things that the Constitution seems to address, rights-related things, particularly when it comes to civil rights, there have been dramatic changes in America over its history. At the same time, these things change slowly. For the most part, they change slowly. Does the Constitution, or maybe then it's what it means for the shape of American politics, does that somehow contribute to what seems sometimes to be a glacial pace of change, or does that in fact again reflect the fact that while people do change their minds and society changes its mind, that also is a pretty slow process?
My own view is a combination of things here. Overall, in general, you see relatively slow changes, and that's because in order to accomplish something substantial, you have to get a lot of people in a lot of places around the country to vote in the same way in a series of elections. So again, the two-year, four-year, six-year terms, those matter in affecting the rate at which change can occur. Similarly, the fact that senators are elected from states and are not elected in a national constituency also affects that. But the other part of the story is that very occasionally we have what I would call, I guess, great presidents, a dramatic leadership by a single person who is able to get a lot of people to vote the same way pretty much all at once. So the examples that are standardly used are in the 20th century, Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. They managed to transform the national government in quite substantial ways, even in the face of a sort of generally slow-moving system.
Yeah, although there certainly have been other times when people have come into office seeming to have some kind of a mandate for change of that degree, and I think maybe we have one right now, where it seems that can evaporate awfully quickly, and you wonder, well, what exactly is the difference?
Right. Issues associated with this kind of presidential leadership is exactly what are the circumstances under which somebody can pull it off. And it's probably worth emphasizing that when you get this kind of presidential leadership, and I'll say something about President Obama in just a moment, when you get this kind of presidential leadership, it does usually take a little bit.
I believe we've lost the guest. Hold on a second there, and we'll get the guest lined up again. Occasionally this happens when we're doing programs like this over the telephone. Something happens and the guest drops off, but we'll put the call through again and we'll get him back on. Our guest, let me just take the opportunity to reintroduce our guest, Mark Dushnet. He is a professor of law at Harvard University. He is a constitutional scholar, specializes in teaching about, thinking about, writing about the Constitution. He's the author of a recent book. The title of the book is Why the Constitution Matters, and it's published by the Yale University Press, and it's a part of a series that they have begun where all of the books that have that kind of title, Why Something Matters, and they deal with a range of different subjects, and this is just the most recent, Why the Constitution Matters. And we have reestablished our connection there. I'm not sure what happened there, Professor Dushnet, but please continue. Professor Dushnet? Well, we're having a little problem here. We'll see if we can get it worked out here in Urbana, Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call in, be a part of the program, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We do also have the possibility of email. You can give us a call You can write us if you want to do it that way. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, of course, we also always welcome people to be a part of the conversation. If you have questions, you can just pick up the telephone and you can give us a call. Again, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we also have that email. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we seem to be having a little trouble here with our phones. We will see if we can get that straightened out and get the guest back on. Just maybe I'll mention real quick that up in the second hour, I think we should have an interesting conversation. We'll be talking with Nicholas Carr about a book that he's written. The title of the book is The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. It looks at the fact that we now have so much access to so much information. A lot of people argue, well, that's a good thing. More information, the better. There are also others who say, well, you know, that maybe having that kind of information and jumping from one thing to another so easily, maybe that's not so good for our brains. Some people certainly have made the argument that over time, and that the internet is partly responsible, that we've lost our ability to think carefully and deeply for an extended period of time about something. We'll see if we can get some thoughts from the guest, Nicholas Carr, in when we talk with him in hour number two. We'll see if we can figure out what's going on with our phone system here, so just bear with us. We'll be back with you in a moment. Well, let's try again here and see if we have our guest, Professor Dushnet.
Yeah, I think they're doing some work on the phone lines.
Oh, great. What a good time to pick. Well, anyway, I'm glad. I appreciate you hanging in there, and we've got you back. And if we can try to pick up your thought where you were when we lost you.
Sure. The Reagan Revolution was a real change in our government, but it took him somewhere between 4 and 6 years really to get it embedded in the government, and even then, it took a while to work out. I agree with your suggestion that President Obama at least sees himself as having the potential to be the kind of transformative president that Reagan or Roosevelt was. To assess whether that's actually happening right now is probably a mistake. There's just not enough time has passed.
Mm-hmm. Well, something else, again, this goes back to this idea that the Constitution structures our politics and that which makes them distinctive. I don't know that there are very many places around the world, certainly other industrial democracies, they don't have the kind of president we have. They have parliamentary systems, and that's a very different kind of politics. And the president, our president, is a very different individual. What he can do, it's a whole different thing from being a prime minister.
That's certainly right. The president is the head of a political party, but not in the way that a prime minister is the head of the party in parliamentary systems. Scholars who look at these systems around the world do think that there's something like the emergence of a presidential system in parliamentary democracies today. So Tony Blair played a role in British politics pretty similar to the role a president plays in U.S. politics. At the same time, in general, there's much stronger party discipline in parliamentary systems than there is in the U.S. We've been moving to a system of quite strong party discipline. So prime ministers can typically accomplish more quickly than presidents can, and than U.S. presidents can. But we may be seeing some convergence around the world.
Mm-hmm. We have this idea on the one hand that somehow we're voting for this individual and his agenda, and that's in some way an expression of popular will. And at the same time that we have this system, I'm not quite sure I understand it. I don't think that very many people do, this circuitous system for selecting the president, where in fact when you go into the voting booth and you're checking off the candidate of your choice, you're actually not voting for that person. And again, from time to time, people say, well, shouldn't we really do what we think that we're doing and change things and make it so that we are in fact directly electing the president, and it is an expression of our popular will?
The fact that we vote for these presidential electors actually probably doesn't matter much, because the electors are committed to vote for the president, the candidate that they say they're going to vote for, and they, you know, almost always do, and it's never been consequential that one or two electors have been what are in the literature called faithless electors. What really makes a difference is that we accumulate these votes on a state-by-state basis rather than nationally. And so it's possible, and it's happened, that a person becomes president with having less than a majority of the votes of the American people. And occasionally, as happened in 2000, fewer votes than the leading candidate against him. Overall, in 2000, President Bush had fewer votes than Vice President Gore, but he became president. Now, that's something that, you know, might be troubling. It doesn't happen very often, and there might be reasons for doing it, but doing it this way. But it is, as you put it, indirect, and sometimes leads to odd results.
And it seems that at least over the last couple election cycles, there has been more than I remember in the past, people saying, well, why do we have the Electoral College? Should we have it? No, we shouldn't. Let's get rid of it. And people, that comes up. Now, it seems every 4 years it comes up, and then the election's over, and then that goes away. And that doesn't come back again until we get close to the next election.
At which point, nobody has an interest in disturbing the system because they've invested in running under the existing rules. I think that's right. There is, I find, an interesting ongoing process. I just saw that, I think Massachusetts just voted to do this, to set up a system in which you would, in effect, have nationwide elections. The idea is that you get states to say that their electors will vote not for the person who gets the most votes in their state, but for the person who gets the most votes in the nation as a whole. And if you get enough states to do that, then you get a nationalized election. Whether that's a good idea or not, is you can have a lot of discussion about. This movement is sort of inching its way forward.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Mark Tushnet. He's professor of law at Harvard University and is author of the book, Why the Constitution Matters, and it's published by the Yale University Press. The book is out now, if you'd like to look at it. Another of the big questions that you take up in the book has to do with the Supreme Court. And in as much as you ask the question, well, why does the Constitution matter, you also are asking, well, why does the Supreme Court matter? Now, just recently, we have been thinking about that a lot because we have someone has been nominated to take their place, and it'll be the second justice nominated by President Obama. So there's a lot of attention on the process. There is attention been focused on the court and its political makeup and what that means. Though if what we're saying is the Constitution in and of itself maybe is not as important as the kind of structure that it gives to American politics, now you start thinking, well, what exactly does that mean for the Supreme Court? Because early on you say, well, inasmuch as the Constitution itself is not the guarantor of our rights, then perhaps also you have to say, well, the Supreme Court is also not the guarantor of our rights. And in fact, you know, maybe their job really isn't to make pronouncements on rights. And so that gets you to the question, well, what is the Supreme Court for?
I'd put it a little differently. It may be that their job is to pronounce on rights, but that job may not be as important as people occasionally think it is. You know, law professors think it's really important. Other people think it's important when, as you suggest, there's a nomination or something like that going, or a very major decision that comes down. But for me, what matters is not particularly what rights they enforce, but how they go about figuring out, or rather, how we set up the court in a way that generates the kinds of results that they come up with. And again, the way we do that is through this interaction between presidents and the Senate, which we're seeing right now with the Kagan nomination, which, if things work the way they ought to, generally keeps the court pretty much where the American people are comfortable with it being.
Hmm. Well, that's here. I think that gets at a really interesting idea, and it is a different way of thinking about the court, or at least the people don't think about the court in this way. And I think that again goes back to so much that we hear about the idea that what the court is supposed to be doing is interpreting the law, full stop, and that it's about what the law says and it's about what's written on that piece of paper, and that you know, the fact that we have justices that talk about original intent tends to reinforce that notion. But the fact of the matter is that the Supreme Court is a political body. It is it's shaped by politics. It's responsive to politics, and it's even responsive to public opinion. But that seems to kind of go up against what people think the court is supposed to be all about.
Here too, I think the story is a complicated one. There are some surveys about this sort of thing. When you ask people, should the court interpret the Constitution in light of original meaning or original understanding, you get lots of people saying yes, something like 60 to 65%. When you ask the same group of people, should the court treat the Constitution as a living document so that it's responsive to contemporary needs and values, you get roughly the same numbers, maybe a little more, like in the range of 70% saying yes. So we simultaneously want the court to be focused on the document that was created in 1789 and amended since then, But also, we want the court to be responsive to our current values and problems. And what happens in the nomination process is that different parts of that ambivalence get expressed by different people, sometimes in a much harder-edged way than occurs, you know, if you're talking to somebody in the neighborhood bar or at the, you know, local Applebee's or whatever, where we probably tend to be more subtle than the politicians tend to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, earlier in the week I talked with a professor of law from Georgia who had done something interesting that, as far as I know, and she said, hadn't existed before. And she and a colleague had developed a searchable database that had information in it from the confirmation hearings, all of the confirmation hearings that had ever been held. And so it gave you an opportunity to do things like, well, look at what questions the senators asked the nominees and how those things changed over time, and also gave you an opportunity to ask questions to look at things like, well, what sort of things do Republican senators ask, and what sort of things do Democratic senators ask, and the nature of the questioning, how it changes when depending upon who is the president, depending upon what party the president comes from, and so forth. And you could definitely see how politics factors into all of this. But I guess go ahead. Maybe you had some particular comment about that.
No, all I was going to note is that the phenomenon of hearings on Supreme Court justices is relatively recent.
Mm-hmm.
The televised hearings, of course, are even more recent. And the fact that, you know, we have these hearings and that they are televised is an indication of the way our politics has affected the composition of the Supreme Court. In this way, indirectly, but, you know, our senators want to explain to their constituents why they're doing what they're doing and articulate for their constituents what they think the right way to go about interpreting the Constitution is.
Mm-hmm.
On the whole, I think that's a good development. These hearings are sometimes not all that illuminating, but sometimes they are.
Yeah, but one of the interesting things that I learned, for example, as you say, is that for something like the first 100 years of its existence, the Senate Judiciary Committee, they never met personally with the nominee. The nominee didn't come in, sit there in front of them and answer questions. They just didn't do it.
Right.
And it wasn't until maybe around 1930 was the first time that ever happened. And then it was sort of spotty up until the 50s.
Right, right. That's an indication of the way our overall politics affects the particular politics of judicial nominations. One way I sometimes try to capture this is that in the 1800s, from 1860 to 1900, basically Supreme Court nominations were part of patronage politics. It was a way of rewarding your political allies, or an opposition was sometimes also just patronage-based. There was one fully qualified nominee, who was rejected by the Senate because he came from the wrong faction of the Republican Party. The idea of patronage politics was widespread at the time, and it affected Supreme Court nominations. Now we have a much more ideological politics, and we have more ideological contention over the nomination. But the basic story is, again, with some qualifications around the edges, the basic story is that the politics of judicial nominations is just like the politics of the other issues that are going on in Congress at the time.
And when we come around to a point like this where we have a vacancy on the court, so there the president does have the opportunity to select someone, and then we go through the whole process, it seems very obvious that, you know, presidents have particular political agendas, and they're looking for people that align with them ideologically, and that makes you think, well, in some way, do we sometimes look at the Supreme Court as being some kind of extension of the executive?
Now, that is also a very interesting and tricky question. Obviously, the president has the initiative in choosing somebody. The Senate, by the Constitution and by tradition, has a process, has a role of advice and consent. The advice sometimes occurs beforehand. President Clinton actually consulted with Orrin Hatch on who might be an acceptable nominee. But mostly what the Senate does is provide or not provide consent. So the president really does have the initiative, but it's constrained a bit by the fact that the president has to be sure that the nominee will eventually be confirmed. Again, the studies seem to indicate that over the modern period, when presidents pick people who have been affiliated with the executive branch, like Solicitor General Kagan, when they're appointed to the court, they tend to be a little more president-favoring than other nominees who come from other kinds of backgrounds. So to that extent, the combination of the presidential initiative and choosing people with executive branch experience, you end up with a court that is maybe a little more president-favoring than it otherwise would be. I wouldn't exaggerate the effect of that, but it's there.
All right. We have a couple of callers. Let's talk with them, starting with line one, a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really like your idea about the Constitution as a framework for politics. It's really an original idea. But I've always thought the Constitution, I think of it today, and I probably will to the day I die, is one of the great documents of about the individual, the right of the individual. And mentioning the individual in any kind of political document was, I don't think, previously known. I mean, the French Enlightenment, of course, talked about it, but I'm sure that Jefferson and all the major founders and writers of the developers of the Constitution were. But one of the things I've always admired about the Constitution was you can use it as a way to think of yourself as exempt from an oppressive government, unlike people that lived in Europe, Asia. In the 18th century, 19th century, there were just a lot of autocratic rulers, and you basically had no personal or individual rights. And it's just, to me, one of the great documents in human history. And could you comment on that? Thank you.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think you're right in saying that one of the deep, deep features of the Constitution is that it is a charter for self-government, our government of ourselves, so that we are, again, in some sort of ways that lawyers sometimes talk about, we are citizens of the United States, not subjects of the U.S. government. The French, you know, citizens in the when there was a monarchy, were subjects of the king, not citizens. We're citizens of the United States. That's really important. The idea that we are, that this is a document about self-government. What I want to stress is that even with respect to the individual rights that are protected, we want to make sure that we are self-governing with respect to the identification of our rights. It's always contestable what, you know, whether a particular statute violates freedom of expression or not. And we don't really want to give up the authority to decide what our rights are to somebody else, to become subjects of them. And that's particularly true about the Supreme Court. I think it's a bad thing for us to think about the Supreme Court as telling us what our rights are. Again, that's sort of why this nomination process and these interactions matter. Those are the ways in which we become self-governing with respect to the kinds of things that the court does.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We just have about 5-6 minutes left, and I have another that I'd like to get to. Our guest, by the way, is Mark Tushnet. He's a professor of law at Harvard University. And if you'd like to read some more of his thinking on the subject, you can look for his book, Why the Constitution Matters. That's published by the Yale University Press. Our next caller is in Normal on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'd like to get back to something you talked about earlier about presidential power changing a bit because of foreign affairs becoming more important. And I'm wondering, I've heard it's been said that presidential power has also increased in recent years because of strong presidents and with things like signing statements that President Bush used so much. And then they've said that once that happens, other presidents will kind of keep using those same strengths. So I'm wondering if you agree with that that's part of what is those kind of behaviors or events are part of what's changing the presidential part to be so much more powerful, and if you think that's a good thing.
I think that there has been a growth in presidential power starting, well, typically dated to World War II, and increasing pretty much regularly since then until now. The World War II date is significant, of course, because that's when the U.S. started to get really involved in international affairs around the world. I'm less sure that the idea that there's an inevitable growth from one president to the next is true. There's, you know, some growth over time, but I think presidents have their own visions about what their proper role is. George W. Bush had a very expansive vision of presidential power. It's not clear to me that President Obama shares that vision. On some issues, he has continued to do what George W. Bush did. On other issues, he hasn't. The caller mentioned the presidential signing statements. The number and quality and character of those statements has changed quite dramatically since George W. Bush. President Obama has not eliminated signing statements, but he's scaled back on both the number and what he says when he issues the signing statements. So I think it will vary from president to president, even within a system where, as a general matter, there's a growth of presidential power.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left, and I'm interested in actually asking you to talk a little bit about, specifically now, about the relationship between the current court and President Obama. And people maybe will recall that this year in his State of the Union address, President Obama made some critical comments about a particular ruling of the court in a particular case. This was one that had to do with campaign finance, the Citizens United case. And he made some comments, and he essentially stood there in front of the Congress and said that he felt that the court had made a mistake. Now, the members of the court were there. Chief Justice Roberts was very unhappy about this and afterward said something to the effect of, well, if he's going to bring politics into this whole State of the Union thing, next year we may not show up. And that led to some reporting about the president and the Congress, and I read stories saying things like, well, maybe it looks like the administration's going to take on the court. And I'm just not exactly sure what that means and to what extent the administration has any ability to take on the court.
That's an extremely interesting question. I think we are at a very interesting moment in constitutional development. We won't know, I think, really, whether there will be an occasion to take the court on until after the 2012 elections. But if President Obama is reelected and retains majorities in the House and Senate, both of those are real issues, of course. But if that happens, then I think we will face a real prospect of a confrontation between an extremely conservative court and a moderately liberal administration and Congress. The sticking point will be if the Roberts Court invalidates the individual mandate in the healthcare legislation. Conservatives are very upset about that. Conservatives outside the court are. And they'll be pressing for a resolution of that. If that happens, the president's going to be extremely unhappy. What he can do is an interesting question. I don't think there's been enough thinking about this sort of possibility of confrontation and what might happen in the event it occurs to be able to say what it would mean to take on the Supreme Court. But I think there's a real chance that something is going to happen.
Well, that I'm sure that what people find themselves thinking about is the experience of Franklin Roosevelt and his conflict with the Supreme Court of his time. And what he, maybe people remember, what he tried to do was he said, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll just add a bunch more guys to the court and that way get enough support on the court for my agenda. And that he couldn't do it. But other than some sort of dramatic restructuring of the court, which seems just not possible, I don't understand what it is that the president would be able to do.
Well, in fact, I think the Roosevelt example is a good one. Roosevelt failed in trying to pack the court, but as he was doing that, there was what most scholars regard as a sort of strategic adjustment by one of the justices of the court of his own position on important issues. And then right after the plan failed, there was a retirement by one of the conservative justices, and that gave Roosevelt a chance to appoint a reliable liberal, and then everything went smoothly from Roosevelt's point of view. The retirement was not strategic. This was a justice who had wanted to retire for quite a while. The possibility of vacancies occurring unexpectedly or, again, a strategic retirement by somebody who wants to defend the court's reputation against this, being taken on by the president. Those things are possibilities that might come into existence in a few years.
Well, at that, we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Again, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you look for the book Why the Constitution Matters. It is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Mark Tushnet. He is professor of law at Harvard University. And Professor Tushnet, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
WILL is your source for comprehensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Each night of both conventions, NPR will bring you live reports and analysis on WILL AM 580. The PBS NewsHour will provide live coverage on WILL TV. Our national convention coverage begins Tuesday at 7 p.m. from the GOP National Convention in Tampa. WILL is your source for in-depth election news.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we enter the last hours of trading for this Tuesday. We're seeing futures coming off of the lows made earlier today in grain and soybean pits. Pairing the early declines, looks like we're seeing an exhaustion, at least today, of the selling pressure that we've seen, and that is uncovering some light buying as traders continue to hold huge bets, and especially if you look at those non-commercial long positions, that prices are still going to rise. The strong underlying demand for beans and the tight supplies of soy and corn is remaining a strong supportive feature. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at